Chances are you've been hearing about the 2026 congressional midterm elections for months, but the tri-state's new year in politics has more to watch than just those races. There's a gubernatorial election in Ohio, a new state budget debate in Kentucky, and big revenue news in Indiana, plus blockbuster bills that could have an impact on families' day-to-day lives. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about what to watch in regional politics this year are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Capitol Chronicle Editor-in-Chief Nikki Kelly. Welcome back, everybody, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy 2026.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to have you all here. Karen, I want to start with you. Ohio has this gubernatorial race coming up. Republican Vivek Ramaswamy has President Trump's support. Dr. Amy Acton, a Democrat, has the endorsement of former Senator Sherrod Brown. What competition do you think they'll face in the primaries?
I think the way has been cleared for both of them. I mean, there is a candidate who has announced that he's running against Vivek Ramaswamy. His name is Casey Puttish, and I have not yet talked to him, but he seems to be really skewing toward the further reaches of the Republican Party, really talking a lot about, say, abolishing property taxes and things like that. Ramaswamy comes into this race, though, with a ton of money, not only personally. He's a tech billionaire, but he also just announced that he raised almost $10 million during the second half of 2025, and that is already surpassing a record-setting $9.7 million raised during the first half of the year. And that's money that doesn't even count his own money. So he comes in with a lot of money. So if he has to spend some money in the primary, it probably won't hurt his overall spending when it comes to the general, unless somebody really big gets behind this other candidate. Amy Acton seems to be the only Democrat in the race, with former Congressman Tim Ryan saying late last year that he was not going to run. So it looks like that's the matchup, though, of course, on the Republican side, there is a little bit of a contest.
Has Governor DeWine endorsed either of them, Karen?
No, he hasn't. And he really is the highest profile Republican, I think, out there who has not endorsed Ramaswamy. I mean, Senator John Houston, who's on the ballot this year against former Senator Sherrod Brown, he has endorsed Ramaswamy. A lot of members of the legislature have. Ramaswamy really was for a while the only one in the game. He even pushed out Attorney General Dave Yost, who had wanted to run and basically just decided not to. DeWine said to reporters at the end of last year that he's been talking to Ramaswamy, sitting down with him, learning a little bit more about his perspective, and also sharing DeWine's own perspective with Ramaswamy, because they do, I think, diverge in a couple of policy areas. But he's not endorsed him yet. He says he fully expects to endorse the Republican candidate for governor, but he has not done that yet.
Well, Karen, Ramaswamy has said he'll make a special announcement Wednesday. He hasn't given any details. What, if anything, can you tell us about that?
I'm guessing that's his running mate, because a decision needs to be made by both candidates on who their running mates are going to be by February 4th, which is the filing deadline in Ohio. So that's my estimation. The hot gossip is that it's Republican Senate President Rob McCauley, who announced that he is not going to run for Congress. He's from Northwest Ohio. The announcement's being made in Cleveland, which I think is interesting. Obviously a Democratic stronghold, but McCauley is not from Cleveland. So you've got some people wondering if that is in any way significant. But we'll find out on Wednesday. I'm going to drive up there and find out for myself.
Okay, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you. Well, Ramaswamy's also come out against bigotry in his party, especially against Indian Americans and Indian Republican politicians. How does he position himself in the party? He's such a Trump loyalist when he's also coming out against this bigotry.
Yeah, he's definitely a Trump loyalist, so he's really chasing MAGA voters in Ohio. There is a bit of a split that seems to be developing in terms of supporters of Republicans in general, but he is not Christian. He's Hindu. And of course, he is Indian American. He was born in Cincinnati. His parents were immigrants. So you're seeing a lot of really unfortunate, nasty, racist stuff on social media that specifically relates to him. Nick Fuentes, the well-known white nationalist has said he's going to campaign against Ramaswamy. So it really is opening up some very, very ugly things that have been happening, at least online. Whether this translates into a loss for him at any point, that's, I think, to be determined, because social media is not the real world. So I think that that's been something to watch here, though, and certainly something to pay attention to, because that's very concerning when a candidate is, when you've got people rejecting a candidate based on their race, their religion. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people would agree is not the way to decide on who your candidate is going to be.
Yeah. Well, Sylvia, there's no gubernatorial race in Kentucky this year, but there is a state budget that will need to be approved. And Kentucky has a budget shortfall to manage, doesn't it?
Yes. Now, that applies to the current fiscal year. So this upcoming budget will apply to the two fiscal years after this one. But the reason why it's notable is that we've really had surpluses for several years now going into budget sessions. So this could indicate there's some turn in fortunes a little bit here, that we might be approaching some tough budget decisions. It's a pretty small budget shortfall, all told. But again, it's a pretty big reversal from having a surplus to going into a shortfall.
Do you have a sense, Sylvia, for whether this kind of turn of fortunes means that the state could have to make cuts? Could this set up a potential fight between Republican leaders in the state house and Kentucky's Democratic governor, Andy Beshear?
Well, there's always fights between Beshear and the Republican supermajority. He's called for several years now for universal pre-K. He's really pumped up that effort in the last year. He really wants it to get done, because this is his last budget session as governor. He still has two more years, but this is the last budget that will cover that span. And so it's his last chance to get this done, really. And it seems unlikely at the moment, just based on the rhetoric from Republican leadership. They have not shown any movement on that. They, you know, aren't showing a lot of interest in starting new, big, expensive programs like that. But the real argument within the Republican supermajority here in Kentucky is, I think, going to be over the income tax. So some House leaders, most notably Representative Jason Nemes, who is the House whip, have called for cutting the income tax again. We have a structure in place here in Kentucky to continually cut that income tax so long as we hit certain budget triggers. We didn't hit that this year. We didn't hit it in order to lower our income tax another 0.5% in coming years. But he said we should go ahead and do it anyways. We missed it by a really small margin, and so we should just go ahead and cut it. Leadership in the Senate have said, no, we're not interested in doing that. We didn't hit the trigger. Let's wait until the next year. So I expect there could be some fighting. They may have already resolved that in the interim. That was a few months ago that they had that kind of argument. But, you know, obviously cutting the income tax has been one of the big Kentucky Republican priorities for many years now.
Well, I want to issue a correction of something our listeners might have heard me say over the weekend. We had promos that said Indiana has a budget session this year. Nikki set me right. That was wrong, and I regret that error. Nikki, how's the revenue picture looking in Indiana? Last I saw, things were better there than expected.
Yeah, so it's been a little fascinating. Lawmakers passed our current two-year budget last session in 2025. And at the time, you know, they had a forecast that said they're going to take in new revenue. And then at the very end of the session, right before they finalized the budget, there was a upgraded forecast, and it said we were going to get $2 billion less. So they slashed the budget, right? And so for the past half of year, we've been laying off state workers and canceling contracts and really trying to save money. And then all of a sudden we got another new forecast in December, and shockingly it said, oh, hey, you're getting another $2.4 billion.
Oh my gosh, that seems like a lot of money.
Yeah, so, and this is the $2.4 billion is over two fiscal years. So, and so basically now I think the discussion is the budget is not open this year, but I know Democrats specifically will want to say, hey, what are we going to do with this money? If we do nothing and we just follow the budget as we passed, we'll end up with a surplus of $5 billion, which is extraordinary. They'd like to put it in places like childcare vouchers and Medicaid and SNAP. But Republicans will have to fight back those efforts to spend this new money, which of course is a forecast, but you know, we'll be seeing it come in month after month.
Sure. And Indiana has a pretty short legislative session this year. Do you think this big revenue news could have a big impact on that short session?
I think the Republicans, since they have supermajorities in both the House and Senate, they'll be able to hold off any big budgetary moves. They just don't like to open it in the off year. We normally would get out in mid-March, but because our lawmakers went in December to battle out over new redistricting maps, we are supposed to end by the end of February. So there's not a lot of time for them to really get into those kinds of discussions.
We are talking about regional politics and what to watch for in 2026. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100. Or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Nikki, you mentioned that December activity at the State House in Indiana. State lawmakers had that contentious debate in Indianapolis over redistricting. Remind us how heated that got.
Yeah, it's honestly still going to reverberate. The whole discussion started back in August when the Trump administration started pushing, you know, very solid GOP states to try to redistrict. Eventually, the governor called a special session. The entire time, Senate Republicans were resisting. And the Senate said, look, we don't have the votes for this. And, you know, they still went in. They were warned that they didn't have the votes, and it was defeated very soundly. And so we had the House Republicans support it, Senate Republicans not, obviously joined by Democrats who were against it, because it would have eliminated two Democrat districts in Indiana. Currently, the makeup is 7-2. So, you know, there were a lot of threats made for primarying people. We've got our candidate filing deadline opening soon. And so, yeah, things are pretty raw right now in the Republican Party in Indiana.
What do you think the continuing fallout could be from all that, Nikki?
Well, I mean, the main thing we're watching for is primaries against some of the Senate Republicans who voted no. There's been some discussion about whether the Trump administration would be, you know, sort of holding back opportunities for Indiana, whereas we've been such a solid partner in before with Governor Mike Braun. You know, there's definitely some concern that, you know, we won't be on the top of the list for programs or funding because the Trump administration's pretty disappointed.
Hmm. Well, Karen, Ohio's redistricting process went very differently. Talk about how Democrats and Republicans on the state's redistricting commission really came together to approve a new map.
Well, Ohio had to do congressional redistricting because of the way the last congressional redistricting had come about, and we did not have bipartisan agreement on that, and so the map had to be redrawn. And so during the whole process, there were questions about whether Ohio was going to be pressured by the Trump administration and J.D. Vance, of course, who's from Ohio, to change the map and make it more favorable to Republicans. And so the process, very carefully described in the Constitution, went from a legislative committee, then to the Ohio Redistricting Commission, and then it was supposed to go back to the legislature, the full legislature, to decide. But at the last minute in the Ohio Redistricting Commission's part of this, there was a bipartisan map that was introduced by Republicans and was agreed to by Democrats. And Democrats, the two Democrats who were Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio and House Minority Leader Dani Isaacson, said they agreed to this map because they had seen other maps that Republicans were talking about that made it even worse for Democrats. And so this map would actually make the two districts currently occupied by Democrats, Marcy Kaptur in Northwest Ohio and Greg Landsman in Cincinnati, a little bit more favorable to Republicans. But then it would tip the district currently represented by Democrat Amelia Sykes more toward Democrats. And so I think that Democrats are really hoping, with the way things worked out last year and with the way that the midterms seem to be shaping up for 2026, that they will at least be able to maintain the status quo, which right now is 10 Republican congressmen and 5 Democratic members of Congress from Ohio. They're hoping to maintain that, though the map does suggest that it could be a 12-3 map. So we'll just have to see what happens. But I think there was a lot of anger, at least initially, toward Democrats for agreeing to this deal that Republicans had proposed. But they said that they saw the writing on the wall and that there were worse maps that could have been put into place, and they would have gone through with a supermajority vote potentially.
Hmm. Well, we do have a caller on the line. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I was thinking about Jim Jordan and the prominent national role that he's taken in the Republican Party. And I'm wondering what, if anything, has he delivered for his constituents? I just have no idea. And I was wondering if anyone on the panel did.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy. Karen, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't really cover the local congressional districts just because we cover things from a statewide perspective. But obviously, Jim Jordan is a well-known figure to everybody in Ohio, I think, at this point, anybody who watches politics anyway. And it's been brought up several times that he really hasn't introduced bills that he hasn't made anything like that happen. But of course, he is a favorite of Trump. Republicans in his district have overwhelmingly voted for him over and over. His district did not, I don't think, substantially change in this new congressional redistricting. So it seems very likely that he would be on the path to being reelected. Because, I mean, quite often in districts now, whoever wins the primary is going to win the general election for whoever is representing the party that the district is tipped toward. So I think that, you know, he certainly has been criticized significantly by people on the left side of the spectrum. And there are certainly people who are in his district who do not agree with him. His district is pretty widespread and stretches pretty far up toward some Democratic areas. But, you know, that's a really interesting point that he arguably has not passed bills that really do bring home anything for his district. But that has not seemed to be his role as of the last, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years at least, if not longer.
Hmm. Are you seeing any kind of trend here in terms of what you hear about representatives in Congress from people in their districts, like complaints among constituents that they're, you know, dealing with more on the national level than they are on kind of local business or legislation that would help their constituents? I know you said you're covering things from a statewide level, but are you hearing things like that these days?
Well, I think that there's frustration with things like property taxes, which are a local and state issue, not a federal issue, that certainly lawmakers at all levels are hearing about. I think the concerns about affordability, especially as the Trump administration has pushed back saying affordability is a Democratic hoax, I think they said at one point, Trump himself said that, you know, those issues are big deals to people who are really struggling to afford housing and food at the grocery store. And now, of course, the healthcare premiums that are coming forward that have risen and the enhanced ACA premium subsidies have expired. That's something that Congress is going to have to be working on in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, certainly lawmakers are hearing about these things from people who are directly affected. So the economy is a huge issue. It always is. It will be this time around. But whether people are willing to blame their individual member of Congress, their individual state lawmaker or whatever for those things, that's always the issue. Because it seems like you see people putting very negative ratings on elected officials, but yet they continually vote to support the one in their district who's running. And that's always been kind of an interesting dichotomy I've seen in politics in general.
Yeah. Well, coming up, the congressional midterms could get nasty. Stick with us. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our conversation about regional politics and what to watch in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana during 2026. My guests are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, Indiana Capitol Chronicle editor-in-chief Nikki Kelly, and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau chief Karen Kassler. You can join the conversation. Just call 513-419-7100. Or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sylvia, I referenced, we were talking about the midterms a little bit earlier, and Congressman Thomas Massie certainly has the congressional reelection campaign to watch in Northern Kentucky. President Trump is backing his primary challenger. Remind us why that is.
Yeah, so Thomas Massie has certainly got on the bad side of President Trump a few times this last year, and even before that, he was a no vote on the One Big Beautiful Bill, which obviously passed on a razor-thin margin, and he's also been one of the lead lawmakers pushing for transparency on the Epstein files, and, you know, for example, he's been a staunch opponent of the rate of the incursion into Venezuela, things like that. He's just repeatedly pushed back against President Trump when perhaps other Republicans refuse to do so or choose not to do so. And he has gained Trump's ire as a result, and he has supported his primary challenger. In fact, before he even had a primary challenger, he said, I'm going to find one, and they're going to run against you, and I will support them.
Well, and I know Congressman Massie has been very popular in his district. I mean, President Trump certainly won Kentucky by a very wide margin, but Congressman Massie's been very popular in his district. Do you have any idea whether that challenger that President Trump is backing is gaining any traction?
Well, yes, you're right that Ed Gowrain, that's the challenger to Thomas Massie, he does not have nearly the name recognition that Thomas Massie does within his district. Obviously, you cannot compete really with Trump's name recognition, and he has great popularity within the state. But Thomas Massie is really well-loved in his district. Like you said, he's gotten a lot of national attention, and I think that he taps into this very liberty-minded or libertarian mindset in Northern Kentucky. You know, people who don't mind someone who pushes against the status quo, who flip-flops sides, who doesn't just stick with a party line. There's a respect for that within his district, and that's how he's able to maintain support there, even in a crowd that is also very supportive of Donald Trump. So, you know, the question of does Ed Gowrain stand a chance? Of course he does, because he's going to have a lot of money coming in behind him. He's going to have the support of Trump. And in a lot of races in Kentucky, Trump's endorsement would mean everything. But in this case, it doesn't. I think it's going to be a really interesting primary. I think Thomas Massie at this moment probably still has a good edge, but it's really worth watching. And we're going to see a lot of ads pouring into this district. We already are.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get into the U.S. Senate races. Karen, Republican Senator John Husted is running to keep his seat. Democrat Sherrod Brown is challenging him to try to regain a seat in the Senate. How close and how expensive do you think that race could be?
Close, yes. Expensive, yes. I think it's going to be a big race. I think the entry of Sherrod Brown as a former senator to try to regain his seat in that chamber is a big deal. There are very few senators who have even tried it, and of course, even fewer who've been successful. Sherrod Brown has had popularity and success even during the Trump years. I don't think he's ever been on the ballot when Trump was on the ballot directly. In 2024, I'm getting my years confused. Yes, in 2024, he was on because he lost his seat to Bernie Moreno. Mm-hmm. So, but he's had success during this Trump period in general. And there are Republicans who do like Sherrod Brown's approach. He's considered kind of a populist. And there are Republicans who have shown that they are willing to vote for him. But this state has definitely fallen along lines of Trump and Trump's backed candidates. Senator John Husted, former lieutenant governor, was appointed to that seat to replace J.D. Vance when he won in 2024 and became vice president. This is his first election to that position. And it's going to be a challenge, I think, for him. He's certainly got to push back against some of the things we were talking about when it comes to affordability and Republican policies in Congress. But he's well known. And the question, of course, will be, is he as well known as Sherrod Brown, especially since he is taking on a different role here? He had really talked about running for governor for many years and had filed paperwork, had started working on his campaign, and then DeWine appointed him to the Senate. So this is going to be a race to watch, because you do have two veterans, unlike in the governor's race, two veteran experienced candidates who are running for a political office, while on the Republican or on the governor's side, you have two candidates who have never held elected office. So this is going to be a really interesting 2026 when it comes to those two high profile races in particular.
Karen, do you expect those federal health care subsidies that you referenced before, do you expect those to be a big issue in this Senate race?
Well, it's. I think, at least looking at things right now, then yes, definitely, because there are a lot of Ohioans who are affected. You've got a lot of Ohioans who say that they are not going to re-up their health insurance because they can't afford it because those subsidies have expired. Now, the question is that going to be something that's going to be resolved and be a factor still in November? And, you know, that's always a question, because while you look at things now and think this is going to be a huge issue and it's what people are talking about, well, things could change a lot in the next 10 months or so. And so I think what Congress does in this month when it comes to those subsidies is going to be incredibly important. And you're definitely going to hear Sherrod Brown talking about it. John Houston, maybe not as much, because he's been working on this issue and has not had a ton of success. But obviously Republicans, it's a huge issue for Republicans and for Democrats, and especially for those who are challenging in these races.
We're talking about regional politics today for the full hour with journalists who cover the state houses in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Well, Sylvia, in Kentucky, Senator Mitch McConnell, a former Senate Majority Leader, is retiring. Tell us who's running to try to replace him.
Oh, yes, that is a crowded race. I hope I don't miss anybody when I try to list them. The Democratic side is just as crowded as the Republicans, although I would say there's three top contenders, or three at least most well-funded, most out there contenders on the Republican side. That would be former Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who also ran against Beshear for the governor's race and lost. There's Congressman Andy Barr, who currently serves the kind of Lexington district. And there is Nate Morris, who is a businessman who has kind of pushed himself as the ultra pro-Trump, super anti-McConnell candidate. And then on the Democratic side, we have a very long list. But the kind of the big names that people will recognize outside of the state are we have some very familiar names here. We have Amy McGrath. She is running again. She was very famous for running against McConnell and losing with a very expensive budget behind her. And then we also have Charles Booker, who also ran in the primary against McGrath. And then again, she ran as the top Democratic candidate against Rand Paul. We also have a really huge group of somewhat unknown Democrats, but they seem to have pretty organized campaigns behind them. First-time candidates, people who are previous public servants. We also have a very prominent horse trainer, Dale Romans, running. And, you know, Logan Forsythe, the former U.S. Secret Service agent. We have Joel Willett, who is a former CIA operative. So we have a really interesting mix of candidates here. And they're all going to be, I suspect, relatively close races.
Well, for decades, Senator McConnell mm-hmm. has kind of held a grip on this seat in Kentucky. And, he's popular among many, unpopular among many, but he kept getting reelected. Do you think there are so many Democrats running? Do you think the Democrats feel like they have a realistic chance now that he's out of the mix?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think, realistically speaking, Republicans have a very strong hold on this seat. It would be very difficult for a Democrat to win. Like I said, some of the two biggest candidates running have previously run for the Senate, including for this very seat against McConnell, and lost by pretty large margins. I mean, that being said, they were running against McConnell, right, who, you know, behemoth in this space. He really, you know, made that Senate seat. But at the same time, you know, it is a staunchly Republican state. It would be very hard to flip it, I think. But it really, I think it also depends on who ends up coming out at the top of this Republican ticket. Like I said, we have three really different candidates, although they're all vying for that Trump endorsement at the end of the day.
Well, Nikki, a different race in Indiana. Indiana voters are going to see the name Bayh on a statewide ballot for the first time in, I think you said, a decade. Tell us about Beau Bayh.
Yes. So our former governor and U.S. Senator Evan Bayh, it is one of his twin sons, Beau, and he's running for Secretary of State. And so, you know, he's a young, smart veteran who went to law school, and he is working hard so far, doing a lot of events. He does have an opponent in the on the Democratic ticket first, that if she stays in and if they both file, that will be decided at convention. But his goal is obviously to take on Republican Secretary of State Diego Morales, who has had a lot of interesting, I'm not going to go quite as far as scandals, but, you know, lots of questionable spending and contracts and things like that. And so that Democrats here are pretty hyped up about Beau Bayh. My one warning to them is if, you know, Beau Bayh doesn't make it through and can't beat Morales, I think they will be pretty demoralized. I mean, a name with a lot of history. He's already raised over $1 million in only 2 months. So he's got money, he's got name ID, and if he can't break through, that would be very demoralizing for the Democratic Party.
Right. So, I mean, is the Democratic Party, is the idea there that if a Bayh can't do it, what's the future of the Democratic Party in Indiana? I mean, it's been such a strong Republican state for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Democrats here in Indiana are generally struggling with the idea of, you know, how progressive are they versus instead going after the moderates or independents. And so I think that's an ongoing discussion, and this would be an example to see how that goes.
Okay. Well, we are going to take another quick break. Coming up, what do claims of daycare fraud in Minnesota mean for families in the tri-state? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to wrap up our first regional politics show of 2026. My guests are Indiana Capital Chronicle Editor-in-Chief Nikki Kelly, Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Kentucky Public Radio Capital Reporter Sylvia Goodman. Do you have questions or comments? Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Let's get into some legislative priorities. Karen, Governor DeWine signed some legislation in December to offer property tax relief for Ohio homeowners. You were talking about what a big issue that's been for homeowners in the state. Do you expect more bills on that this year?
Well, at last count, there were about 50 bills deal with property taxes in some way or another. And yeah, DeWine did sign about four of them. That specifically related to trying to cap the growth of these increases in property tax that Ohioans have seen. And the actual impact for many Ohioans may not be that significant. I mean, we're talking about, you know, maybe a couple hundred dollars in some cases, and not all Ohioans. And so you've got this movement going on in Ohio right now, an all-volunteer effort to gather signatures to put a constitutional amendment before voters in November that would abolish all property taxes in Ohio, which no other state has ever done. And an all-volunteer effort to get that kind of signatures, and we're talking more than 400,000 signatures, is pretty significant. And I don't think I've ever seen that be successful in Ohio. But obviously, people are very upset about property taxes. So you've got a lot of activity going on at the local level to try to get those signatures. They have until the end of June, first part of July, to file those signatures with the Secretary of State's office to see if they have enough to make the ballot. But I think property taxes, just between that and the governor's race, where you have both Vivek Ramaswamy and Amy Acton talking about property taxes, it's going to be a big issue coming up. And the two things that have propped up in both the recent reports we've seen from state lawmakers and elected officials and others on recommendations that Ohio lawmakers should take on property taxes, these two have been proposed, but they've never moved. And that is a circuit breaker, which triggers a property tax cut when a household income reaches a certain point, and then also an expansion of the homestead tax exemption. And those are bipartisan. They've had support, but they've not moved forward. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of discussion around those two in particular, but it's going to be a big, big issue, I think, this year.
Nikki, what are state lawmakers in Indiana thinking about when it comes to property tax relief? That's been a big issue there, too.
Yeah, last year, Governor Mike Braun pushed a pretty far-reaching income property tax cut bill. Lawmakers backed pretty far away from it, but they did include some property tax relief that Hoosiers will see this year. Similarly, a couple hundred dollars, I think it's 300 max, for homeowners. But in the meantime, you know, some of the changes they made, which were the process came kind of fast. There were clearly some issues with how the bills were written. So they are expecting to have to tweak that and provide some more flexibility for local governments who won't get this revenue anymore to deal, including possibly more flexibility on local income taxes. So it's still going to be a discussion here for us, though leaders are saying nothing major, just tweaks around the edges.
Sylvia, what will Kentucky lawmakers be looking at when it comes to housing costs?
Oh, I mean, housing costs is a really big issue here. Now, property taxes haven't so much come up as a topic of conversation. There's always a few bills filed, but really the focus of the Republican supermajority in Kentucky is on income tax cuts. But housing costs, everyone agrees that housing is a problem, that we have shortages in almost every county, including in rural areas, and that it's too expensive. A lot of the suggestions made at the moment are around changes to zoning rules to make it easier to build housing, potentially tax credits for low-income housing. There's a lot of different solutions coming up, you know, maybe giving a break to religious institutions to make it easier to build housing, things like that. So those are some of the things that Republicans are looking at. Democrats have also called for more investments in our Affordable Housing Trust Fund. There's a lot of different ideas out there. It seems like a lot of them would be pretty incremental, you know, trying to slowly hack away at the problem. That's been building for a long time now.
Well, Sylvia, I know Republican lawmakers in the House are backing recommendations from the Make America Healthy Again Kentucky Task Force. What do some of those recommendations include? What are the priorities there?
Sure. I'd have to look up the specifics, but right now they are a little bit more on the vague side, but they're kind of leaning into this food as medicine rhetoric, the idea that we need to partner more with our agricultural forces here in Kentucky to make food healthier and more locally sourced. So that, I can imagine, has some bipartisan support. Another thing that I saw in that list of recommendations was something that several other states have done, which would be asking for a waiver from the SNAP program, from the federal food assistance program, to not allow people to spend their SNAP money on junk food, you know, sodas, chips, things like that. So that was one of the recommendations. Have to look for more details on what that would really look like. But a few other Republican states have done that as well. So that seems to be their focus, you know, looking more holistically at health. Obviously, there are a lot of parts of Kentucky, you know, that have some really poor health outcomes, that people have lots of different chronic diseases all at the same time. And I think there's a real desire to try and and help people manage or, you know, avoid chronic disease in total. And so I think that's where that a lot of those recommendations are coming from. It's just a really a question of how do you accomplish that, especially in the face of coming cuts to Medicaid.
Nikki, we've talked about this shortened time frame that Indiana lawmakers will have to deal with this session. Are you expecting debate during the session around gaming?
We are. There's a couple different bills that are already moving. One of them got passed during the interim in December when they were debating redistricting, and it involves putting a casino in the Fort Wayne area, either moving one from Rising Sun or just a whole new license. And so that'll be interesting discussion because Indianapolis reps would love to have it in their area too. Though if you put a casino in Indianapolis, you're going to hurt some other casinos that already exist. Whereas the Fort Wayne, Northeast Indiana area is a pretty untapped market. Similarly, we're also looking at a possible online, moving our lottery online, allowing them to sell tickets online and also have these interactive games online that you can just gamble on your phone from. So that will definitely be a big discussion. And just listening earlier there, I just wanted to point out that Indiana is one of the states who got a SNAP waiver. And starting on January 1st, our SNAP recipients are not allowed to buy sugary drinks or some snacks. It's kind of interesting seeing what certain things are covered and certain things aren't. For instance, you can buy ice cream, but you can't buy a candy bar, you know, some things like that. And so I think the retailers are really going to be struggling with that in the next month or so as people get used to these new rules.
Yeah, trying to figure that out. Well, Nikki, what about debate around the death penalty? Do you think that'll be a priority for Indiana lawmakers this session?
I think it will, not necessarily ending the death penalty, although we do have a bipartisan, small group of bipartisan lawmakers who would like to end it, but that doesn't necessarily seem like it has any support. What we have had is we had a 15-year layoff of any executions because we could not procure the drugs. Last year, we had our first one again, and we've since had two more. So we've had three. But the problem is to get these drugs, we've moved to pentobarbital. It's really expensive. We've already spent over $1 million, and several of the doses have just gone to waste. Because obviously, when you're moving through a court hearing, these court proceedings don't follow along with the expiration date of a particular drug they buy. And so there are some bills filed to expand the death penalty to beyond lethal injection, to firing squads or nitrogen hypoxia. So I think those will probably get a hearing. In fact, I think one has a hearing tomorrow. So,
Karen, Nikki mentioned a small bipartisan group in Indiana that would like to abolish the death penalty. Ohio has a similar small bipartisan group, doesn't it? Are you with us, Karen?
Yeah, that's something that's been introduced over and over again in the legislature. And some years there are some more people who've signed on, other years not. When I asked Speaker Matt Huffman and Senate President Rob McCauley about that for our year-end interviews, it seems that they are not too positive that either of those bills will move in the House or the Senate. But Governor Mike DeWine has said that he's going to do something when it comes to the death penalty in Ohio. We've asked him several times about what he might be working on because we've had no executions that have moved forward since he took office. And he has said that it's been a shortage of drugs, but he's also said that the legislature, if they want to go ahead and continue with the death penalty, they're going to have to come up with another way to bring that about. We've had some interesting ideas that have been proposed using fentanyl and firing squad and things like that. But we expect DeWine to come out with a statement about the death penalty in the next couple of weeks. He said he's working on it, and I think we're going to hear more about that.
Well, I do want to talk briefly about child care. This federal investigation in Minnesota has been such big national news. How are the state's governors responding to this? Karen, we've heard a little bit from Governor DeWine, haven't we?
Yeah, and we're expecting to hear more this afternoon. He's planning to speak about this with his director of the Department of Children and Youth, which he created as governor. And he said that Ohio is well positioned to not have any real fraud in the system, like the fraud that's been alleged in Minnesota. But Ohio is the second largest state when it comes to population of Somali immigrants. And so you're seeing a lot of these daycares and childcares that are run by Somali immigrants getting threats, vandalized. And so he's going to be speaking about that and talking a little bit more about what the state's doing on that. Hmm.
And Sylvia and Nikki, have governors in your states had come out and said anything about these child care issues?
No, it's been very quiet here in Indiana in terms of any alleged fraud in that case. So we haven't heard anything. The child care issues that are being discussed here are more about cuts to our programs. We had to put in a wait list for the child care voucher, and no new people will be able to get on it this entire calendar year. Mm.
And Sylvia, you haven't heard much from Governor Beshear, I guess.
I don't think I've heard anything so far that may be coming down the pipeline. Child care is always a big issue here in Kentucky. Obviously, we have many child care deserts, like I think most states experience. And there's always discussions within the legislature of what is the role of state lawmakers and just the government in general in propping up this industry that is getting more and more expensive and very difficult to operate.
And certainly critically important for parents and for employers. Well, the one thing that I want to talk about very quickly in just the minute or so we have left, data centers. I feel like that's something that is a big talking point in every state. Sylvia, let's start with you. We might end with you on this too. What are Kentucky lawmakers talking about when it comes to data centers?
Oh, boy. We could talk about this for another whole hour, but I think we just have a couple minutes. But data centers is definitely going to be a huge issue in Kentucky. And I bet it's mirrored in almost every other state. You know, localities pushing back against data centers in their district. Obviously, the issue is, you know, what kind of benefits do data centers bring to an area? They take up a lot of space. They take up a lot of energy. You actually have to build, in a lot of cases, energy capacity. Utilities have to build energy capacity to accommodate them. And then what happens if, for whatever reason, they scale back or they leave? Then we're left with paying off these enormous new facilities. So there's a lot of concerns here in Kentucky. What should a city do if a data center wants to locate there? What should the county do? We passed tax credits, or our state legislature passed tax credits to encourage data centers. Now I think there might be some discussion. What should the state legislature do about, you know, these areas pushing back, changing their zoning to push back on data centers?
Yeah. Well, I know that'll be a story to watch for all three states in the new year. I've been talking with Ohio Public Radio State House, Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Capitol Chronicle Editor-in-Chief Nikki Kelly. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.